You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. We strive to provide perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media. If you'd like to know more about us, check out our website at cjsf.ca.
Welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovasar. I'm here with a couple of guest hosts today. I've got Michael Robert Kaditz and Brandon Brownlee here on the show. Alrighty, well, let's get right into it then. As the name of the episode suggests, we today are talking a bit about legal philosophy. I have, of course, a particular vested interest in this topic. I am on my way to law school. I actually just recently did my LSAT, and I'm in some courses now that are talking a bit about the foundation of it, and one of these is the philosophy of law. So, of course, we sort of take the law for granted, I would say, most of us, in terms of it is the governing rules of our behavior that we, you know, the taxes we hate to pay and so on. But really, there's a few centuries worth of really interesting discussion about not just how to implement laws and what laws should contain substantively, but what they are. I mean, if I sit you down and ask you what is a law, would you be able to answer that? And I think for most people, they might have to scratch their heads a little bit about it. And that's because there are a couple of different competing sort of theories or accounts, I should say, of what law is. And we're going to go over a couple of them today. I'll get your thoughts as we go along. And then we're going to talk a bit about some cases, some famous cases from early legal history that is common law history, I should say, that sort of bring home this debate between two groups, natural law theorists and legal positivists. So I'll just start by sketching it out. Feel free to jump in if I miss anything or if you think I mischaracterized something, and we'll go from there. So, okay, when we're talking about what is law, of course, we have some different ideas that have been posited, some different accounts as to what that means. I'm not going to get into all the details about sort of civil law, common law, that kind of stuff. Suffice it to say, the common law system is based on some rules that are unwritten, first of all. So that is the common laws, or laws that are not actually written down, but that are sort of cemented in tradition through English history and then through the Commonwealth. And civil law is the French legal system that here in Canada, Quebec still makes use of. And so most of the courts in the country operate on the common law system, except those in Quebec operate on the civil law system. And that is not so much based on those cemented decisions called precedents, but rather on the actual letter of the written civil law code that, as I've heard, you get handed out in any law school in Quebec. The dean greets you out the door with a copy of the current updated legal code of Quebec, civil code of Quebec. So, right, so I won't get into all of that more than that, but I'm going to take us back a couple of centuries to talking about exactly that. What is the law in the first place as it at its foundation? So the two authors I'm going to be sort of referencing for the natural law position are St. Thomas Aquinas, who many might be familiar with. We've probably talked about him a number of times on the show, and more recently, John Finnis, who is a sort of modern proponent of the same theory, makes some revisions on Aquinas' account. And basically what the natural law tradition says is that law, there's something known as real law. So this is law based in what they call the natural law. And this, for St. Thomas Aquinas, comes from God. The primary difference, or one of the differences between these two authors, is that St. Thomas Aquinas, he believes that this natural law comes from revelation. Basically that God actually enumerates, of course, the commandments, which serve as the basis for the moral basis, I should say, for the legal system that we then create as human beings. Finnis doesn't quite take that step. He doesn't believe that it's revealed theology, but that still law and morality are inextricably linked. So when you think of a law, you know, you might think that law serves the purpose of advancing justice, right? Or at least that courts implement or interpret laws to advance justice for society. That's a view. One I disagree with, but, you know, we'll get to that in a moment. But basically, Finnis and Aquinas are of this camp that say, okay, there are real laws that are based in this moral, natural foundation, and there are defective laws. Basically, if a law isn't based in that foundation, it's no law at all. And that's the thing that's sort of hard to grasp, and perhaps, you know, what people, where the main contention is that on their account, if a law doesn't match that system, if it doesn't come from these natural laws, it's no law at all, and you therefore can disobey it without, if not without practical consequence, at least without moral consequence, because there's nothing sort of obligating you to follow a law that's not really a law. Of course, there's some stuff to unpack there. How do we know, for example, that what is the right law? Well, Finnis has this account called practical reasonableness that basically tells us that, much like we've talked before on my ethics episode about deontology and how you can use reason to find moral claims and moral laws, it's a very similar kind of approach, where Finnis actually enumerates a list of good things for a life, which is pretty ambitious, I would say, as a project. He gives us a list of specifically seven things: life, knowledge, play, aesthetic experience, friendship, this practical reasonableness, and religion or faith. That's a little bit of an iffy one. You can kind of interpret that a couple of ways, but those seven are basically what he calls the goods of a human life. And when you're making law, you cannot sacrifice any one good in favor of another. So a law is good if it advances at least one of these goods, and if it doesn't detract from another. So that's basically Finnis's view. This is a revision of Aquinas, who instead supposes that law, again, comes from revelation, from revealed theology. So his definition of law is as follows: it's a ordinance of reason for the common good, made by him who has care of the community and promulgated. So there's a few elements there. So it's an order, it's a command. We can agree on that, you know, anyone can agree that it is a command of some kind, of reason. So again, coming from reason, for the common good. This is where we're going to disagree. This is the main point of contention that you should keep in mind for later. Made by the person that has care of the community, i.e. authority, a proper authority, and promulgated. Of course, you can't follow a law if you don't know what it is. So it has to be public. It has to be shared. And Finnis says, that's not quite right. There's a little something more to that. But suffice it to say, they believe law is morality. It's simply a kind of morality, and we derive from it these specific laws for specific cases that we make in our communities.
I was just thinking about Thomas Hobbes. Are you going to bring Hobbes into this at all? Because Hobbes' account of what law is quite different in many ways contradictory to either of the authors that you are now referencing. Well, as opposed to law being revealed, Hobbes, I believe, in my understanding, argued that there is no natural law, that laws are constructed by people, that laws are a product of the social contract, quite the opposite of what Aquinas argued. Aquinas, of course, as you said, argued that there are natural laws created by God which are revealed, whereas Hobbes said there are no natural laws, that in a state of nature, it's the war of all against all with no morality and no laws. And that, I believe, is Hobbes' justification for why humans must construct a political state with laws in order to regulate people because there are no natural laws.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a really great summary, and that's perfectly true. So there are sort of four elements that we can think about when we're talking about what makes up a law. Sort of these are four elements that have been, you know, preserved and put forward by multiple authors over the centuries of the discussion. So we have, first of all, where do laws come from, right? Authority. So a lot of people say that law must come from an appropriate authority. So it can't just be, as the famous example goes, the gunman in the park. So this is a famous sort of thought experiment. Imagine you're walking through the park and you get stopped by someone holding a gun saying, give me all your money, right? And you say, well, why would I have to do that, right? You're not the government. He says, well, okay, if it makes it any easier for you, I am the government in this park. I have the gun. I have the use of force. Anyone that's walking through here, they're getting taxed. So whatever they have on them, they have to bring in tax to me, the government. And you think about that. You say, something about that isn't quite right. You know, there's some authority missing there, or some claim to authority missing there, right? Of course, different ways that authority can be granted, be it divine right of kings or democratic election, but the gunman in the park doesn't seem like he is a proper authority, right? The second would be practicality. So can it actually be enforced, right? And we'll talk about that in some of the cases we talk about later, but it must be possible to obey and enforceable, right? Universality is the third. So law must bind everyone equally, or at least you may make laws for certain groups, like let's say the military has specific laws that, you know, other civilians don't. But in general, you don't say Mikey on Tuesdays has to pay taxes to the Canadian government. You say Canadian citizens, you know, have to pay their taxes to the government. And the last one, which is, again, where the debate is this fairness or justice idea. So these natural law theorists are going to say, yeah, there's an element, a law must be administered fairly and it must promote justice. Whereas Hobbes, like you're saying, he doesn't think law comes from any moral foundation, and he thinks all it is just a contract binding us, holding us together in society. There's nothing greater or underlying that. Yeah, so that's where that disagreement comes from. Although they would all agree that you need an authority. Hobbes would say it's the Leviathan, for example, and that it has to be practical and universal. He'll probably agree with those.
I want to come in on a different angle than what you were just suggesting regarding proper authority and the distinction between the gunman in the park versus a quote-unquote legitimate government. So I want to be skeptical about that distinction and suggest that possibly there is no difference, that possibly governments retain their power in the very same way that the guy in the park with a gun claims and retains power, which is by force. So what this brings to mind is something that's discussed in sociology, which is two ways of looking, of viewing society and what holds society together. Is it, on one hand, coercion, or is it, on the other hand, agreement between people? So is it cooperation, coercion or cooperation? So does the government stay in power and are laws enforced because people are cooperating and they all agree to give legitimacy to a government and the laws that are enforced by that government? Or can we look at it through the coercion model, which is that, well, no, governments only have power because they are there by force, because they have the armies and they are really no different except on a larger scale with multiple people involved and, you know, higher technology involved than the gunman in the park.
Yeah, great point. And that transitions beautifully to the legal positivists, who have an answer for you. So we're going to move to those positivists. The two that I want to talk about in particular are John Austin and H.L.A. Hart. So these are two of the most famous legal positivists. Austin, again, from a couple centuries ago, I guess, and, you know, Hart from more recently, who argue that, as a matter of fact, law and morality, there is no distinction. Or sorry, there is a very strong distinction. They're not the same. They're not related. So as opposed to the natural law theorist, who tells you, yeah, law comes from a specific either God-given or otherwise moral, natural source, legal positivists say no. There may be a relationship between law and morality. It may happen to be that laws promote justice, but it's not an essential feature. It's not necessary for law. Law is, well, it's a much more descriptive approach where, similarly to Hobbes, they would say law is what the law is on paper, and that's because the government said that's what the law is. That being said, there is a rebuttal to that, the gunman in the park, and that's what Hart talks about, which is what's known as the secondary rules, or primary and secondary rules of law. So what he basically says is primary rules are what we think of as the substantive laws. You know, you can't park here after 8 p.m., you can't shoplift, you can't murder people. Those are the primary rules that operate on our behavior, non-optional behavior, if you will. The secondary rules, on the other hand, and this is what distinguishes him from Austin, his predecessor, is that he says Austin's view and other views are a little bit too crude, in a sense. Whereas Austin just says that, yeah, we have some commands that are laid down for us to follow, and we have a duty because we're obligated. He says, yeah, what about the gunman in the park? And Hart tells you, well, actually, there's this set of secondary rules, which are basically laws about laws. So the most important of these is what's called the rule of recognition, which says that in order for a law to be a valid law, it's not that it has to be moral or advance justice, but people have to agree to be bound by that law. So in a sense, when they elect their government and they elect their representatives to put forward, you know, legislation that's read three times and passed through Parliament in the Canadian case, right? That recognition of that process is what makes that law valid. So the gunman in the park was never given the recognition. His laws are not given the recognition of the people he's trying to impose them on, that is what the law is. And that also doesn't just mean that you can follow whatever law you want because you want to. No, it's that you live in a country that has said this is the process for making laws, and if you live here, you agree to those processes, and you agree to the laws that come out of them. He also brings up some rules about rule of adjudication, so how judges should interpret the laws, there's a third rule of change, which is how you change or laws over time. But suffice it to say, that is the answer to your point, Mikey, is that the people haven't recognized the gunmen in the park. And again, this is a much more descriptive view of law. So it's not that laws should be anything in particular. It's that there are good laws and bad laws, right? A bad law for Aquinas and Finnis isn't a law at all. On the positivist view, a bad law is a law. It's just bad. And, you know, you can change it and you can elect a new government and they can change that law. But if the letter of the law, as it's written down, says you do something a certain way, that's how it is. That is the law. Of the land.
I think one of the elements here that is important for explaining how the rule of recognition kind of operates is the distinction Hart makes between the perspective that a law is kind of observed in. So he distinguishes between the external perspective and the internal perspective. And it seems, so the external perspective would be someone has a relationship to the law as kind of an outsider or an observer. So there is the external perspective where the relationship that one has to laws or rules is as an outside observer, and you watch other people obey these laws, and it's almost behaviorist in a certain sense. Your relationship to the law is such that it is kind of explanatory of other people's reasons for actions, but you don't necessarily accept those laws yourselves. You kind of just say, okay, well, these are laws and it explains behavior in this way. But there's also an internal perspective, and the internal perspective is where things get normative, where people act on these laws because these are the laws, where people live their lives in terms of accepting these laws as reasons. They predicate their beliefs on these laws. They take an internal perspective on them. It's interesting that both of these have a descriptive element, though, and that's the upshot of legal positivism, is that it is descriptive through and through. So from the external perspective, you have a description of laws going on, but from the internal perspective, you can't really explain or you can't really describe the relationship of the normativity of the laws, but the internal perspective describes the fact that people live their lives according to these laws. So both of them operate on a descriptivist level.
Yeah, and once again, to clarify, there is no essential link between the normative aspect and the descriptive aspect, in the sense that, basically, as I read it, the externalist view basically... So he says that if you're extreme externalist, where you're just looking at people, sheep obeying their woven government, that's, you're basically ignoring the social aspect of obligation that people feel on the internal view. And that's where obligation, a good point, that's where obligation comes from. Because you might think, okay, well, if I'm not morally obligated to obey the law, what's making me obey it? And he says, well, first of all, there's this sense of agreement, this recognition that you agreed to be bound by these laws. Secondly, that there's this social aspect of obligation. And there's, of course, the sanctions, the charges that come if you don't obey the laws and if you harm other people. And diverging from these laws gives us reason, good reason, to be hostile, or for enforcers to be hostile to people that break these laws.
So what's interesting, not just in this discussion, but I think in general in discussions around law and criminal justice and so on, is I think a general acceptance, whatever particular iteration one chooses to subscribe to, whether it be natural law or whether it be social contract, or some of the other theories that you're talking about tonight, Mihai, the general thread that runs through them all is a general acceptance that laws are in some way important for a well-ordered society, and to protect people, and to promote happiness and well-being. And I want to suggest another approach which lies outside of that generally accepted premise, which is that perhaps laws can be viewed as a nefarious tool for those with power and status to maintain their power and status. And I don't want to diverge too much from your path here, Mihai, but at some point, if not now, maybe later, I wanted to talk about a whole nother model for viewing laws, probably outside of any of the theorists you talked about tonight, which is... I would call it a evolutionary psychology view of law, but that could be another topic for another time. And I'll leave that up to you.
Yeah, no, I do appreciate you saying so. So, maybe what we'll do is, once we talk about the cases today, we'll come back next week or another time and discuss some alternative approaches to these and see what we have to say about them. But you're right. So there is a sense in which the laws are seen as, whether constructed or derived, they are seen as a necessary tool to order social society and, as you say, cohere, act together, preserve one another's interests and our own interests, primarily our own, I suppose, from one another. And yeah, it takes a view of, are we behaving this way because it's just and right and fair? Or are we behaving this way because that's how we agreed to do it in order to sort of preserve our interests, right? And this is just how we are behaving. And so that, again, cuts the line between the normative natural law theorists and the descriptive legal positivists. I also wanted to mention, so again, all of these different aspects that we talked about, authority, practicality, universality, and fairness, they're things that we can debate about and we can discuss, right? So as an example, when we come to the cases, I'll sort of state both views, but express why I think that the legal positivist view, in my view so far, does a better job of describing how we should treat laws and how judges should interpret laws. Because you might say, okay, which of these aspects is more important? Is our goal to advance a fair and just and equal society where we treat each other with respect and we further some common goods that we whether decide on or just argue that there are certain common goods that we want to further? Or are we just following the letter as it was, you know, written on ink on parchment by, you know, from the founding fathers all the way to today, right? So that really is what underlies the two views here. I think we're close enough to the halfway point that I'll take a pause here to say you've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Mihai Kovacer. I'm here with Michael Robert Gaidetz and Brendan Brownlee, and we are discussing today legal philosophy of law, and two camps that basically underlie the development of this field, namely legal positivism and natural law theory. So let's talk practically. Let's get a couple cases on the table, and I want to hear your opinions, your intuitions, and then maybe your theoretical arguments on whether the courts ruled in these cases was correct or not. So the first one we're going to talk about, these are all fairly famous cases from the UK, from, you know, that are sort of cemented in Commonwealth, again, common law tradition. The first of these is Riggs versus Palmer. So the Riggs versus Palmer case from, if I remember correctly, I don't have the year on me, actually, but regardless. So the Riggs versus Palmer case, and by the way, these are all a little bit dark, so be warned. But basically, the Riggs versus Palmer case goes as follows. So there is a grandfather who has a will and testament. He bequeaths most of his property. He's a farmer. This is in the 1800s, I think, mid-1800s.
1899.
Okay, thank you. Late 1800s, 1899. And so he has a farm, and he bequeaths most of his property to his grandson, Elmer Palmer. And some goes to his daughters, who married name is Riggs. And what happened is, the grandfather expressed, according to Elmer, some intent to, as the judge put it, intent to revoke this will. And the grandson, wanting to enjoy the hasty, hasty enjoyment and acquiring of these goods, goes ahead and poisons his grandfather in order to have the will enacted before he can get the chance to change his mind, if he did indeed want to do so. And the question facing the court is, should Elmer actually get this inheritance? Now, the other facts that are important here to know are that in the letter of the law, there is nothing saying in the statute that this is not permissible, that he would not be allowed to get his inheritance. There is, in fact, an enumerated list of cases where the inheritance wouldn't be allowed to go through, legally, and this is not one of them. And the court is faced with the decision whether or not to, the majority by Justice Earl, the majority, which, if for those of you that aren't aware, so the majority is basically the ruling the majority of the judges agree with, and that's the holding. That's the result that is pursued after the case. So the majority argument goes something like this. Well, it may not say in the statute that someone can't kill their own kin to get access to the inheritance, but that the intent, the rational interpretation here, you can't possibly imagine that the intent of the testator, of the will writer, would be that should he be murdered for the will, that they should still get it. So there's something there that seems wrong. It's a principle underlying it, almost like that no one should be a judge in their own case, or that all sides should be heard fairly, that somehow this intent just there's no way that you could rationally assume that this person would still want their will enacted in these circumstances, right? And it's analogous almost to theft or fraud in this case. So despite the fact that it's not explicitly said, he shouldn't get the inheritance.
on the, and you, and I hope you can see the natural law, the normative kind of principle here, right? On the dissent, the other judge that dissented, that disagreed with the majority, said, hold on, by the letter of the law, it's very specific and explicit. In these six cases, the inheritance would be canceled or annulled. In this case, there's nothing saying that he shouldn't get his inheritance. I'm not saying it's a good law.